This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Food, a Love Story. This is the author, Jim Gaffigan. Dedication and Acknowledgement. If you read Dad is Fat, you know that I do everything with the help of my wife, Jeannie. She's my writing partner, eating buddy, and best friend. I would not be an author, father, successful comedian, or the man I am today without Jeannie. She was by my side while I struggled through writing this book, and she helped turn my incoherent blurbs into something readable and much funnier. This book would not be a book without Jeannie. Jeannie believed in me even before people were yelling Hot Pocket at the airport. She was the first person I convinced shellfish were bugs and bacon was candy. Making Jeannie laugh remains one of my greatest accomplishments. Why food? As many of you know, I'm a comedian who, with the immeasurable assistance of my wife Jeannie, wrote a book called Dad is Fat, which chronicled my life as the father of five young children in a two-bedroom apartment in New York City. The book enjoyed some success and changed how people raise their children. Well, okay, fine. The book enjoyed some success. Anyway, I was approached about the possibility of writing another book. I thought long and hard. I knew if I did a second book, I wanted it to be as good or even better than Dad is Fat. I know. Impossible, right? I didn't want to only be known as the really good-looking guy who wrote one terrific book. So like a good author, I spent some time reflecting while I rewatched all six seasons of Lost on Netflix. I then thought about who I am and what I know. Then I had a breakthrough. In the comedy world, what was I known for? What was my comedy associated with? Obviously, I'm known for and associated with, you guessed it, being good-looking. But what else did my comedy say about me? Boom. I was a good-looking comedian who talked about food. This, of course, led to a brilliant idea. What if I wrote a book that was edible? I pitched it to my publishers, who were so trapped in the old publishing model that they got caught up in the how bookstores don't have refrigerators, how to deal with digital delivery, and a bunch of other book nerd stuff. Whatever. It was at that point that I decided to do the next logical thing. I ate a ham sandwich. Then I decided to write a book about food. Curriculum Vitae. What are my qualifications to write this book? None, really. So why should you listen to it? Here's why. I'm a little fat. Okay, to some, I might not be considered that fat. But the point is, I'm not thin. If a thin guy were to write a book about a love of food and eating, I'd highly recommend you don't listen to it. I'm not talking about somebody who's merely in good shape. I'm talking thin, skinny. I wouldn't trust them skinnies with food advice. First of all, how do you know they really feel passionately about food? Well, obviously, they're not passionate enough to overdo it. That's not very passionate. Anyway, I'm overweight. I'll admit it. I consciously try not to take food advice from thin people. I know this may not be fair, but when Mario Batali talks, I always think, well, this is a guy who knows what he's talking about. He actually has experience eating food. This is why some sportscasters wonder what's going on in a player's head during a tense moment in a game. But the sportscaster who was once a player knows what's going on in a player's head. When I talk about food, I like to think I'm like one of those sportscasters who used to play professionally. I'm like the Ray Lewis or Terry Bradshaw of eating. I'm like the Tony Siragusa of eating. Well, that's a little redundant. When a thin person announces, here's a great taco place, I kind of shut down a little. How do they know it's so great? From smelling the tacos? If they only ate one taco, the taco could not have been that great. Or maybe it was great, but the thin person cared more about the calories than the taste. I had to stop at one taco. I'm on a diet. A taco that won't force you to break your diet just can't be that great. Fat people know the consequences of eating. But if the food is good enough, they just don't care. Overweight people have chosen food over appearance. When a fat person talks about a great place to get a burger, I lean in. They know. Speaking of thin people, another person it makes no sense to take advice from is the waiter. Why do fancy restaurants always hire thin, good-looking people to be the waiters? I'll have the hamburger in. I want someone who's at least an 8 to bring it to me. Can I see some headshots? Why would we care what the waiter looks like? Even if we did, why would we take the waiter's advice? We don't know him. He's a stranger. Well, he works there. Does that make him have similar tastes and things you like? Does that make him honest? Not to sound paranoid, but the waitstaff does have a financial incentive for you to order something more expensive.
Well, I highly recommend the 16-ounce Kobe beef with the lobster and a bottle of 1996 Dom Pérignon.
What restaurants really need is a fat guy food expert. Many fine dining establishments have a sommelier, a wine expert to assist in wine selection. But if a restaurant really cares about food, they should have a fatlier.
Fatlier. Well, I'd get the chili cheese fries with the cheese on the side. You get more cheese that way. Me.
Thank you, fatlier.
Although they can't be thin, the food advisor can't be too fat. If they are morbidly obese, then you can conclude that they will probably eat everything and anything and do not have discerning taste. This is not to say that they won't have valuable views. I'd still trust an overly fat person over a skinny any day. The best advice would have a very specific body type, pudgy or just a little overweight. This makes it clear they have somewhat unhealthy relationship with food, but not a clinical problem. They are eating beyond feeling full. Sure, I'm describing my own body type, but that's why I'm qualified to write this book about food. What other credentials do you need, really? Stop being a snob. Listen to the book already. An Edie, Not a Foodie. Now that I've convinced you to listen to this book, I should clarify something. I have strong opinions about food, but I am not a food expert or a foodie. I couldn't name more than 3 celebrity chefs, and I've never posted on Yelp. I have 5 young children and work nightly as a stand-up comedian, so I rarely go out to dinner. What I have is a general and very personal knowledge of food. I know which food I enjoy, I know which food I hate, I know how food makes me feel. I realize that because of my food obsession, the fact that I am writing a book about food could mistakenly give some people the impression that I think of myself as a foodie, but I don't. I think of myself as an Edie. I don't have anything against foodies. I appreciate their love of food, and I envy their knowledge and culinary escapades. But I'm generally satisfied with what I've been eating. Foodies seem to be on a never-ending search for new restaurants and interesting dishes. I don't have an insatiable desire to discover what makes something taste good or to find exotic combinations. I guess I'm not that bored. This is not to say that I don't appreciate today's chefs trying to expand the horizons of the culinary arts. I just don't need a Japanese taco or cranberry sauce on my steak. There is plenty of regular food I still want to enjoy. I wish it were more complicated than that, but it's not. I am also way too lazy to be a foodie. Foodies will travel for miles in search of the perfect hamburger. There's this place in Greenpoint that's only an hour by train and a 40-minute walk from the subway that has the best burger in town. Well, it can't be better than the burger I can get across the street. Mostly, I just want the closest best burger in town. The reason I know about so many great places to eat all over the country is not because I've traveled to these cities or towns to seek out these restaurants. It's because I was in these cities and towns to perform stand-up comedy. All I have to do is ask a food-loving follower on Twitter where to eat in that particular city, and bam, shortly thereafter, I'm cramming my face full of the best food in town. Yes, I'm lazy, but I'm resourceful. I travel a lot, and I like to eat. Besides asking my followers on Twitter or approaching strangers in cities I visit on where I should eat, I do no research. Most cities have at least one food place that locals recommend with pride.
Well, while you're here, you have to eat at this place.
Unfortunately, this is not the case everywhere. Once I was in Rapid City, South Dakota, and asked a cab driver for a local restaurant that was unique to Rapid City. He replied in a very matter-of-fact manner, "There's nothing. You should go to Outback Steakhouse." Nothing. I didn't believe him, so I pressed on. Well, where did you go before chain places like Outback Steakhouse were here?
Nowhere, he replied.
Is it possible the fine people of Rapid City did not eat outside their homes prior to the arrival of chain restaurants? Of course not. Well, hopefully not. I don't know. I didn't do the research. I asked another two people in Rapid City, and nobody had suggestions. Therefore, in this book, there is no reference to some local Rapid City food specialty. This isn't meant as a slam on Rapid City. This is a commentary on my research method, or lack of a research method. If your favorite local food place isn't referenced in this fine book, it's because I didn't go to your town, or the local stranger I asked didn't suggest it, or someone didn't mention it on Twitter. It is also possible that I'm too dumb and lazy to remember the place. After all, I'm an eatie, not a foodie. Why Dad is Fat. I can't stop eating. I can't. I haven't been hungry in 12 years. Once a writer at Entertainment Weekly described me as a human garbage can, which I think he meant as a compliment. Last night I had the following train of thought. Ugh, so full. I guess I'll have some cheese. I don't like this cheese. I guess I'll finish it. I know it's not right. On more than one occasion while eating something, I've thought to myself, maybe this will make me hungry. It's either that or feel my feelings. Jeannie likes to point out, you know, you're only eating your feelings. I always respond, yeah, but these feelings are delicious, especially the ones at night. I wish I had more feelings. Have you ever eaten so much that you feel sick? Well, I love that feeling. I treat my body like a temple of doom, but a temple nonetheless. I often find myself thinking about what I will eat at my next meal while I'm in the middle of eating a meal. I always eat like I'm on vacation or about to begin a period of fasting. I've eaten things and not noticed that they tasted horrible until I was taking the last bite. Afterward, that horrible taste only leads me to want to eat something else to cleanse my palate. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I've contemplated ways that I can incorporate eating while on stage into my stand-up routine. If other comics bring a beer up with them, why can't I bring up a cheeseburger? Comedians with a drink on stage usually wait for an applause break and then take a sip. I could do that. I support the troops. Crowd applauds. I take a bite of my Baconator. When I don't want to eat something, I assume I'm sick and most likely dying. I try to stick to 3 meals a day and then an additional 3 at night. The only time I stop eating is when I'm sleeping. I'm not really comfortable watching television while not eating. It's just too weird. I don't know what to do with my hands. As a result of all this behavior, I'm always full. When the instructions on medication say never take on an empty stomach, I think, not a concern of mine. I'm sure your mother told you not to go swimming until an hour after eating. This is a virtual impossibility for me. Technically, I should never go swimming. Thank God this hour rule is not actually against the law, because if you ever saw me in a pool, you would think, arrest that man and ask him not to wear a Speedo. And in this hypothetical scenario, if I went to prison because I ate too soon before swimming and wanted to protest the injustice of my sentence, a hunger strike would not be an option. I'd cave after 15 minutes. Yes, not having food for a short time compromises my principles. If I went to a shaman for help with this problem, he would never tell me what my spirit animal was for fear I would eat it. My wife thinks I'm eating myself to death, and if I am, it's taking me longer than I thought. Not Slim Jim. As a result of my constant eating, I'm not thin. Sure, my beard probably hides none of it, but at least I know why I'm not thin. When most people gain weight, they rarely admit that it's due to the food they're constantly shoving in their mouths. We blame external forces.
Well, work has been stressful. That was a brutal winter. I have young kids, which makes you hungry, right?
I'm not in denial. I realize I could lose half an ounce or two of weight. I take full responsibility for the reality I've created, even if at times it feels like I'll never lose this baby weight. That's the price of being a father. The truth is that it was I alone who caused my weight gain. Luckily for me, most of my girth is intentional. I don't want to brag or anything, but I'm preparing for a big roll. Sure, it's a cinnamon roll, but I don't want to look like I can't finish it or spell it. Some people lie about their age. I lie about my weight. Sometimes I catch myself telling total strangers that my belly is not real, that I actually had to get stomach implants to ward off female suitors. This strategy generally fails because I've caught women staring at my gut. I usually point to my eyes and say in a very condescending tone, "Hello, I'm up here," After all, I'm not some piece of flab for anyone to oogle at. Once after a show, a woman told me, "You're not that fat," like it was a compliment. I held myself back from answering her, "You're not that polite." I'm not sure how overweight I am, because you're supposed to find out this information by calculating your BMI. Once I found out that did not stand for Big Mac included, I stopped trying. There was a time when I was thin. Sure, I was 6 years old, but I'm confident I can get back into those clothes. Actually, around the age of 7, it became very obvious that I had the body type of someone who would have to work out twice a day just to look out of shape. I struggled through my 20s and 30s, and then one day I looked in the mirror, saw my belly, and said, "I give up. It's all over." It wasn't defeat as much as acceptance. I figured, I got a hot wife. If she leaves me for getting fat, that means she's shallow. "Honey, do you think looks are important?" "No? Good. Now pass the gravy." Around the time I tricked Jeannie into marrying me, I lost a primary motivator for staying thin. Additionally, my career as a comedian was never affected by my waist size. Even my occasional acting roles were as a character actor. Character actor is, of course, entertainment industry code for not attractive. It became clear that being thin was never going to put me in competition with Brad Pitt. By my 30s, I'd auditioned to be Matthew McConaughey's unattractive friend in 3 movies. I didn't get any of those parts because I wasn't cute unattractive enough. The other reasons to be thin just seemed downright esoteric. You'll feel better and have more energy. Next. You'll live longer. Next. Then the reasons just get silly. There's an old Weight Watchers saying, "Nothing tastes as good as thin feels." I, for one, can think of 1,000 things that taste better than thin feels. Many of them are 2-word phrases that end with cheese. Cheddar cheese, blue cheese, grilled cheese. Even unsalted French fries taste better than thin feels. Ever eat fries without salt on them? I always think these could use some salt, but that would mean I'd have to get up and move. I guess I'll just imagine there's salt on them. Eating fries without salt on them feels like a sacrifice. What am I, a pioneer? When I have to eat unsalted fries, I often feel like I should be a contestant on Survivor or something. I look forward to telling Survivor executive producer Mark Burnett, "Well, once I had fries without salt on them, so I could probably live anywhere." I realize weight is a serious issue in America, but I also believe some people should be fat. We all have that friend who has lost tons of weight, and whenever you see them, you secretly think, "You look better fat. Go back to being fat. You're thin, but you look exhausted. Even looking at you makes me want to sit down." Obviously, losing any amount of weight is an accomplishment. Obesity is a big problem in our society. This is a well-known fact. Another fact is there seems to be a general insensitivity to our obese fellow citizens. It seems once a week there's a news segment on American obesity. They always show some big person walking. They don't show their face, but that person has to know that's them. They are probably just sitting at home watching TV. "Well, that sure looks familiar. Oh, crap. Looks like I can't wear that again." That poor guy probably gets to work and is greeted by a coworker. "Hey, Fred, saw your fat ass on the 6 o'clock news." Now it seems like obesity is an industry. At this point, the countless number of documentaries on obesity just makes me hungry. I feel like the insensitivity toward obesity reached its peak with the television show The Biggest Loser. The show seems to be an elaborate insult masked by stories of inspiration. The following is what I think occurred in the meeting when the show was pitched. Producer: "Hey, I got an idea for a show. We get really, really fat people to lose weight, and everyone watches them struggle and fail."
Network executive: "That's good. I'm laughing already."
So wait. So we make these really, really fat people run around, jump up and down, more or less torturing them.
Funny. We get to abuse them. We'll love it.
Just thin people get to yell at the fat people, right?
Of course.
So there will be these thin, attractive judges, and we'll have the fat people weigh in on national television.
Do they have their shirts off? That would be extra humiliating.
Fine, no shirts. Here's the kicker. Whichever fatty loses the most weight wins the title, wait for it, The Biggest Loser, get it?
Because they're all losers, because they're fat, right?
Of course, but the winner is the biggest loser, because he or she has humiliated themselves the most on national television, and I suppose maybe lost some weight.
We could probably pay them with Twinkies and Ho-Hos, right?
Sure, you know, some kind of food or something. While we are torturing them, we make them wear these huge insulting T-shirts that say,
The Biggest Loser?
Their big fat bodies will serve as slow-moving billboards for the show. It'll save on advertising.
Oh, I love it. I have to go. I have a Pilates class now.
Proud American.
If obesity is an epidemic in America, then what caused it? I can only speak from my own experience, but I will just go out on a limb here and guess it was caused by American eating. I'm very American. I don't mean that in a boastful way. I'm just saying my habits and passions surrounding food are those of a typical American. Not to generalize, but generally most Americans have an unhealthy relationship with food. Unless, of course, you're one of them damn commies. Maybe it's the exposure to a lifetime of McDonald's commercials. Maybe our country couldn't handle the post-World War II financial boom. Maybe we are just better than all the other countries at eating. In any case, consuming food of any kind feels a little more important in the United States. We seem to always be eating. If aliens studied Earth, they would come to the conclusion that the United States is somehow consuming food on behalf of other countries. In America, we have gone way beyond sustenance. Eating is an activity. Why don't we go to lunch and then we'll grab some pizza? Most Americans eat constantly, and when we are not eating, we're chewing gum. We are literally practicing eating. We chew gum with a swagger and a purpose that says, Yeah, I got a big meal coming up. I'm training for Thanksgiving. There are many elements that make up the American attitude toward food, but some are consistent. There always seems to be an unending dissatisfaction with and a constant need to improve upon the status quo of food. Americans are never satisfied when it comes to a food item. The hamburger could never remain just the hamburger.
You know what would be good on this hamburger? A ham sandwich. Instead of a bun, let's use two donuts. That way we can have it for breakfast. Look out, McGriddle. Here comes the donut ham hamburger.
I came up with this silly concept for my 2006 comedy special Beyond the Pale. And then in 2012, Dunkin' Donuts made me sort of a food prophet by introducing this very food item that I had hyperbolically predicted. I wasn't surprised, really. Dunkin' Donuts is only responding to an ongoing public desire for innovation and variety in our food. It's the new American manifest destiny. We are the ones who, for some reason, need a potato chip that tastes like steak and Jim Beam jalapeno-flavored sunflower seeds. The variety of flavors is only matched by the speed at which we need them. Of course, when the word fast is associated with American eating, it is the opposite of the word fast as it relates to abstinence from food. When people in other parts of the world hear the term food fast, they envision a time of spiritual and physical cleansing. I hear food fast and I envision a drive-thru. I like things fast. I don't like lines. Whenever I find myself in line for an ATM behind two people, I always think, what is this, Russia? Americans want our food fast. That's why those fast food value meals are so successful. It's less the value and more the speed. You just have to say a number, 2, and your food is on its way. Soon you won't even have to speak a word. It'll just be a noise. And your meal will be placed in front of you. Fast and easy is the American way. We start indoctrinating our children into this mindset at a very early age. My children eat this yogurt that comes in an astronaut tube that they can just squeeze, and the entire serving of yogurt is expelled into their mouths. We don't want them to waste their time lifting up a cumbersome spoon. They are even starting to package baby food in a squeeze bag. I hear soon they are coming out with a variety of kids' foods where these squeeze bags come with an elastic strap so they can just put them around their head and walk around all day wearing a squeeze feed bag. Why should they even have to lift their hands to their mouths? What a waste of energy. Let's keep it fast and easy. I am a fast eater. I normally am the first one to finish eating my entire plate of food at a restaurant, and then I have to just sit there and stare at everyone who has barely unfolded his or her napkin. I never know what to say. Do you think they're going to bring back the basket of bread? My wife likes to pause before the meal with our kids and say grace. Well, I think this is a great opportunity for our children to learn to appreciate the gifts that God has given them. I view grace as kind of the on your mark, get set, and the amen as the go. I'm pretty sure that's the way God intended it. The faster we eat, the fatter we get. Statistics show that the amount of money spent on weight loss programs in the United States alone is much larger than the amount of money it would take to solve the world's hunger problem. The answer to this dilemma seems perfectly simple. Americans should just start eating people from starving countries. When you watch late-night television, it becomes abundantly clear that as a culture we are struggling with our weight and have little desire to make any real effort to remedy the situation. The exercise equipment and weight loss techniques sold late at night emphasize painless alternatives to actually eating less. Machines and routines that only take moments out of our busy lives between meals are constantly touted. I have even seen a late-night commercial for a pulsating belt that works your abs while you watch television. All these weight loss techniques point to the fact that we can't stop eating. There are diet programs where all your meals are mailed to your home. How absurd. We can't even be trusted to go out and buy the food we know we should eat. You'll just screw it up. I'll do it. We are totally out of control. We're a country that loves to eat so much that instead of learning how to eat less or honestly exercising, we find ways around it, like wiring our mouths shut or undergoing surgeries in which our stomachs are stapled smaller.
I don't want to do something barbaric like exercising, so I'll just have someone vacuum the fat out of my body.
Instead of eating less or spending money on get-thin-quick schemes, I have just accepted the fact that I, like most Americans, also have a totally unhealthy relationship with food. And therefore, as a result, I'm overweight. As I mentioned earlier, the meal isn't over for me until I feel sick. Instead of food giving me energy, I'm always tired after I eat, which explains why I'm always tired. I go to the gym just so I will stop eating for an hour, which I believe is the American form of fasting. The buffet rule. If anything defines American eating, it is the quantity of food we consume. This would explain why the all-you-can-eat buffet is such an American phenomenon. It makes perfect sense that it started in Las Vegas. Some of the most amazing restaurants in the world are in Las Vegas, but the real local specialty is the all-you-can-eat buffet. Buffets are as common in Vegas as glitter and regrettable behavior. The Vegas casino buffets are expensive and ridiculous. In other words, completely American. You can get sushi, mac and cheese, and donuts all in the same meal. God bless America. One of the main reasons that the all-you-can-eat buffet is a perfect fit for casinos is because the all-you-can-eat buffet is the food equivalent of gambling. And like all other forms of institutional gambling, it's rigged for the house. The all-you-can-eat buffet always feels like a challenge. All you can eat. The unspoken rule of the all-you-can-eat buffet is that you must eat the food value of more than the cost of the buffet. My wife Jeannie finds this approach ridiculous, but then again, she married me, so she doesn't have the best judgment anyway. If the buffet is $20, you must eat at least $20 worth of food. If you eat $21 worth of food, you make money, right? It's a rule everyone knows. Eating your money's worth at the buffet is a rule that should be known as the buffet rule, but apparently this term was already used for some tax theory proposed in 2011 that has absolutely nothing to do with buffets. I mean, where are our government's priorities, really? I'm not saying my interpretation of the buffet rule is a wise one. I've never learned my lesson. I always approach a buffet with the same bluster, all I can eat for $20. This place is going to lose so much money. Unfortunately, after a half an hour, I'm always uncomfortably full and mumbling, let's get out of here. This place is trying to hurt people. Why did I do this to myself? It's the overeating equivalent of losing your shirt at the craps table. It's dangerous. The all-you-can-eat title is especially hazardous for someone like me who likes to follow directions. When I approach a buffet, aside from seeing it as a challenge, there's a compliant part of me that hears all-you-can-eat and says, okay, I'll try my best. I don't want to let you down, buffet. The assumption is that I can control myself, that I understand self-restraint and portion control, that I am some kind of nutritional scientist or an adult. There is something very American about the term all-you-can-eat. Do you love your country? Prove it. Let's see all-you-can-eat. Sometimes I hear other words in the phrase emphasized. All-you-can-eat, not all-you-want-to-eat. There is part of me that is relieved that the can part is never enforced. I could see trying to leave a buffet only to encounter some big bouncer. Hey, where do you think you're going? Get back up there. But I don't want any more food. Look, chubby, no one said this was an all-you-want-to-eat buffet. It's an all-you-can-eat. Read this sign. I've seen your stand-up. You can eat more. Really, what most of us need is an all-you-should-eat buffet.
Wait a minute, there, fella. Here's your brunch. One apple and 50 sit-ups.
Cup of gravy. I suppose I've become desensitized to the level of unhealthy eating in America. An 80-ounce soda, all-you-can-eat buffets, and a Wendy's triple only seem like logical options to me. I love the rare moments when I'm truly surprised by American eating. A while ago, I was back in Indiana, in my hometown, walking around the Kmart, or as we called it, the mall. You can typically find just about anything you need in one of these big-box stores like Walmart and Kmart. What I especially love about Kmart is the ambiance. I always feel like I've entered a store that was just attacked by a flash mob. Everything always looks and feels a little disheveled. There will be some random empty shelf. There's always a huge corner display tower of sale products that look like they will collapse on you if you breathe on it. There will be a broken jar in one aisle and an abandoned sock in the next. The selection and layout suggest that this might not be the ideal place to buy a suit or use a public restroom. Anyway, on this fine day, I was looking for diapers when I saw a 70-year-old man walking around the Kmart drinking something I realized later on was a cup of KFC gravy. Now, in full disclosure, I love gravy. Who doesn't, really? It's gravy, after all. But I've never considered gravy a beverage. Even in my most private moments with gravy, I've never contemplated taking a swig. This is coming from someone who drank a product called Yoo-hoo on many occasions as a teenager. The thing I found most impressive was that not only was this stranger drinking gravy, he also wasn't even trying to hide it. When I first spotted the stranger, I saw the KFC styrofoam cup, saw him take a drink, and assumed, well, obviously this guy's not drinking gravy. Then I encountered him again, standing in front of me in the checkout line. It was at that moment I saw the thick brown liquid in the cup and confirmed that it was, in fact, a cup of KFC gravy he was drinking. And then, almost as if to prove a point, he turned around, took a sip right in front of me. Our eyes met, and he gave me a warm Midwestern smile as if to say, "Hey, how you doing?" I nodded and said hello, but was only a bit more than slightly tempted to exclaim, "You realize you're drinking gravy, right?" I don't know what the events were that led up to this stranger drinking the cup of gravy in that Kmart. I like to think he walked into KFC with the intention of drinking gravy. Maybe his order was simple. "Yeah, I'll have a large mashed potato and gravy and hold the mashed potatoes." Maybe in order to avoid judgment or scorn, he ordered the mashed potatoes, got the gravy on the side, and then just threw the mashed potatoes away. Or maybe he could have cared less what anyone thought, which is more likely, since he seemed like a proud gravy drinker greeting the cashier while she scanned his heart medication. I'm no health nut, but I can only imagine what this guy's next medical checkup was like. I picture a doctor in a white coat glancing down at a chart as he walks into an examination room with our gravy drinker sitting on the examination table. The doctor would then tilt his head to the right, perplexed by the results on the chart. "Doctor, Mr. Jones, I've got your cholesterol levels here. Okay. You are aware your blood is not moving." Gravy drinker nods. "This is kind of a strange question. You haven't been drinking gravy, have you? Because based on these test results, you're like 90% meat byproduct." Gravy drinker nods. "We're going to have to register you with the government." I guessed the age of our gravy drinker to be around 70, but I have no idea how old he was or how long he'd been drinking gravy. Maybe he was younger. Maybe gravy drinking is one of those rapid aging behaviors like smoking. Or maybe he was an even older guy, and the gravy-drinking habit had plumped out his wrinkles, so he actually looked younger. I suppose his unique consumption of his gravy cup was voluntary, but I honestly don't know. Maybe his wife was just trying to kill him. Gravy drinker. "Honey, I'm going to Kmart." Wife. "Well, why don't you have a cup of gravy?"
"Well, I guess I could."
"And why don't you sign this additional life insurance policy?"
"Boy, you love buying life insurance."
The geography of American food. People look at a map of the United States and see different things. Some people see red states and blue states. Some people see north and south. Some see east and west. I see food. I'm not saying the geographic areas of the United States actually look edible to me. Not yet, anyway. Although I once saw a potato chip shaped like Alaska. Unfortunately, I ate it before I could take a photo. Anyway, my point is, I travel a great deal as a stand-up comedian. I've performed in all 50 states and eaten my way through pretty much every major city. After my fourth or fifth lap of performing and eating across our beautiful and delicious country, I started to think of the geography of our country as it relates to food. My food geography of the United States, while unscientific, is very personal and brilliant, in my personal opinion. My hope is that one day schools, businesses, and prisons will have the Jim Gaffigan American Food Map hang in their library and or bathrooms. We all have our own unique dreams. I believe the United States is composed of five major food areas. Sea bug land, northeastern coast. Eating barbecue land, southeast, parts of the Midwest. Super Bowl Sunday food land, Midwest, parts of the East. Steak land, Texas to upper west. Mexican food land, southwest to Texas. And smaller unique areas. Wine land, Northern California. Coffee land, Pacific Northwest. Some of my geographic areas of food blur into other food geographic areas. The greatest example would be Texas, which is a convergence of Mexican food land, eating barbecue land, and steak land. I'm not being generous here. It would be unfair to not put Texas in all three of these major food geographic areas. They just do things bigger in Texas. Louisiana and New Orleans in particular are unique to the food geography of the United States. It's almost as if the Mississippi River flowed all its special food excellence down and it drained into New Orleans. There are, of course, other exceptions to my regional distinctions. But first, let's explore these major areas on the Jim Gaffigan American Food Map. Seabug Land. On my food geography map, I've identified the northeastern coast of the United States, as far south as Maryland, as seabug land. By seabug land, I mean those so-called food items you call shellfish. On the surface, naming an entire section of the country after shellfish might appear like an oversimplification. After all, the Northeast boasts many other regional food specialties, and most coastal areas of the United States are littered with shellfish, and I emphasize the word littered. However, shellfish are an integral part of the Northeastern identity. Whenever someone does a bad Boston accent, it's either to say, wicked a lobster. Lobster is as much a part of the New England personality as it is hating all things New York City. All along the Northeast coast, you can find this obsession with things that live in shells. Coastal Connecticut, New York City, and Long Island have a long-standing love affair with oysters. Maryland is not Maryland without crabs. I know technically Maryland is mid-Atlantic, but it must be included as part of the East Coast bug-loving culture. If you can catch something in a net and crack it open for food, those bug lovers will eat it. Shellfish are not for me. I'm from the Midwest, and outside of the occasional shrimp cocktail, I had limited exposure to shellfish, or any other kind of seafood, really. I'm still not sure I, or anyone for that matter, would recognize a scallop in its natural form. Are those the things that stick to the side of the aquarium? Who knows? The French may refer to seafood as the fruit of the sea, and scientists may call shellfish crustaceans, but to me they are creepy, crawly, giant insects on the bottom of the ocean. I have a rule that if food looks like something that would crawl out from under your refrigerator, I don't put it in my mouth. If you like shellfish, do me a favor. Next time you see a really big cockroach, just tell yourself, if that could swim, I'd eat it. I always imagine fish in the ocean swimming along, looking down at the ocean floor, seeing shellfish and thinking, we gotta get an exterminator up in here. There is a reason why Red Lobster and exterminators have the same images on their signs. Shellfish are bugs. They have a shell like a bug, they have tons of spindly legs and crawl around like a bug. I have a four-leg maximum on things I'll eat. They even have antennae like monsters, frankly. Shellfish are probably monsters. You don't have to watch any sci-fi movie from the 60s to understand my point. Consider the following. If you went home and saw a chicken in your house, you'd think, why is there a chicken in my house? But if you saw a lobster, you'd think, we have to move. This is because there is not a nickel's worth of difference between a lobster and a giant scorpion. New England lobster. Lobster! Finding lobster on the menu is fancy. It is rare and pricey. Ooh, they have lobster. Lobster is so special, restaurants go so far as to have tanks of live lobster with rubber bands on the claws. The lobsters always seem to be peering out with a curious expression.
Lobster, what are you doing here?
Patron, I'm going to eat you.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, right. Hey, Harvey, this guy thinks he's going to eat.
Harvey?
Where's Harvey?
In some lobster tank restaurants, diners can choose their own lobster. I always found this strange.
I guess I'll take that one who's really struggling with the rubber bands. He seems rather appealing. Why don't we boil him to death?
I'm always perplexed why I'm involved in the decision process. I wanted to have dinner, not play executioner. All this ritual that I imagine makes PETA members squirm is supposedly justified given everyone's love of lobster. And people do love lobster. For many, it just doesn't get any better than lobster.
I love lobster.
I usually nod in agreement and say, I like butter, too. Really, butter is what makes lobster so good. Each bite of lobster is usually submerged in a small bowl of paradise, also known as butter. Guy number one, how can I eat 3 sticks of butter? Guy number two,
well, I found this giant swimming sea scorpion. Maybe if we boil it to death.
Drawing my inspiration from Julie Andrews and Mary Poppins, I think it really comes down to a spoonful of butter helps the bug meat go down, in, of course, the most delightful way. Even the experience of ordering lobster contributes to its mystique and popularity. Lobster is often listed on the menu as market price, which is code for you can't afford it. The market always seems to be the most expensive market in the area. Lobster also is a unique food that requires its own wardrobe, the lobster bib, which indicates not only that consuming lobster is messy, but also that people don't mind looking like a toddler while they do it. A nutcracker is conveniently provided to the lobster connoisseur so that those who dare seek it out may earn the bounty of the lobster meat in the claw. A lobster knife is used to expertly dissect the tail. The ultimate entree in some steakhouses is often lobster tail served alongside a steak. Yes, somehow the tail of a giant scorpion that can survive in salt water is the gold standard of accompaniment to a steak. I feel that in life these two animals would have been enemies. But there they are together on the plate in some kind of phony, glorious unity. Cow and bugtail. I don't even feel comfortable eating a chicken's wing, and some people crave eating the tail of a lobster. Is that the area near the lobster butt? That's what I want. A little turf and bug butt. The world is your oyster. A century ago, a visit to New York City involved a mandatory stop for oysters. It was like getting lobster in Maine or a house for $5 in Detroit. You had to do it. New York City was where you would see a Broadway show and eat a boatload of oysters. Oysters and clams piled up along every murky dock on the East Coast. Oysters were so abundant that Long Island even has a town called Oyster Bay. I imagine Oyster Bay 100 years ago as a big hole filled with oysters with just a little bay in it. Now finding clams and oysters in their natural habitat is a rarity. What happened? You guessed it. We ate them all. Scientists have recently declared oysters to be functionally extinct. Apparently 85% of the world's oyster ecosystems have been destroyed. Only 1% of the natural oyster population remains intact as a result of our voracious consumption. Oysters are now an expensive delicacy. I just don't get it. I don't even understand how mankind started eating oysters. I'm not saying there were tons of food options back in the 1700s, but oysters, really? How hungry would you have to be to take that leap? Maybe two guys were having an unproductive day of fishing. Man number one. Nothing biting over here. Man number two. Nothing here either. I'm hungry. Me too. Hey, I found a rock with a snot in it. I was thinking of eating it. Go ahead. What does it taste like? Pneumonia. Often on the menu, oysters will be listed as oysters on the half shell. As opposed to what? In a Kleenex? Even the way you were supposed to eat an oyster indicates something counterintuitive. squeeze some lemon on it, a dab of hot sauce, throw the oyster down the back of your throat, take a shot of vodka, and try to forget you just ate snot from a rock. That is not how you eat something. That is how you overdose on sleeping pills. It's not just the East Coast that follows this weird and disgusting tradition. These rare and endangered oysters are found in many coastal areas across North America. It seems wherever there is a murky dock with brackish waters, oysters and clams can grow or spawn from whatever creates them. There are East Coast and West Coast oysters. There are oysters from Prince Edward Island and the Puget Sound, and supposedly they all taste different. Oh, this snot from a rock from this filthy dock area around San Francisco tastes more snotty than this snot from a rock from this filthy dock area on the Gulf Coast. I'm not sure how the price of an oyster is determined.
Oh, this snot from a rock is from the filthiest dock in Nova Scotia. Let's charge $200 for it.
I understand I am in the minority in my view that oysters are only slightly less disgusting than their culinary cousin, the Rocky Mountain oyster. Some of the arguments in favor of oysters seem absurd. Oysters are an aphrodisiac. We know this is a scientific fallacy, but why would anyone ever believe such nonsense? I could just see some guy approaching a woman in a bar. What do you say you and I get some snots from rock and see what happens? Maybe we'll end up at my place. Maybe we'll end up at the emergency room. Let it happen, baby. Aphrodisiac. It is more believable that after you eat an oyster, you're so happy to be alive, you'll sleep with anyone. Once I had a friend defensively point out to me, pearls come from oysters. I never really understood his reasoning, but I explained I make a rule to not eat things that also make jewelry. Diamonds come from coal, but we aren't dipping that into cocktail sauce. I would think that given that pearls do come from oysters, we would not eat them. It seems like a prank played on some not-so-bright business partner. Pearl guy. I'll tell you what, why don't I take the rare jewel, and you can have the snot from the rock.
Non-pearl guy. Okay, well, what am I supposed to do with that?
Pearl guy. You can tell people it's an aphrodisiac.
Non-pearl guy.
Deal.
Maryland is for crabs.
Maryland is for crabs, not for crabby people, although that would make the state more appealing to me, but for actual crabs. This slogan was initially a parody of neighboring Virginia's state tourism slogan, Virginia is for lovers. But it pretty much sums up Maryland's attitude toward crabs. Those Marylanders just love them some crabs. Maryland is for crabs, and by for, I mean rooting for. The University of Maryland's team may be called the Terrapins. The state's football and baseball teams might be respectively named the Ravens and the Orioles. But I think the people of Maryland would have preferred if all the teams were simply named the Crabs. You just enter the state of Maryland, and the incessant crab sell commences.
You should get some crabs. You gonna get some steamed crabs? Why don't you get a crab cake?
I usually just politely ask if I can pay my toll. There is a fascination with the crab that goes way beyond the fact that it is an important industry and export for Maryland. Once Jeannie and I were out to dinner at a crab restaurant on the eastern shore of Maryland, and a stranger, not even our waiter, approached our table and addressed me directly.
Can open us you're not eating crab. Is there a reason?
I didn't know how to respond. After a moment of stunned belief, I was just honest. I thought I'd order what I want. I didn't have the courage to tell the guy I wasn't really in the mood for bug meat. The crab is embedded deeply in Maryland culture. It is common knowledge that every Maryland vacation home must have an image of a crab in every room. Images of crabs even appear in kitchens, on potholders, towels, and bowls, where one would think any logical person would never want to see the image of a bug. Oh, there's a bug at the bottom of my soup. I do not exaggerate. I have seen this crab obsession firsthand. Every summer I attend a week-long family reunion hosted by my amazingly generous Aunt Katie on the eastern shore of Maryland. The climax of the reunion is a gathering at my aunt's house where picnic tables are covered with newspaper, wooden mallets and sharp knives are arranged neatly in empty wooden bowls, and a crate of steamed crabs is placed like a treasure chest in the center of the table. There are even oyster crackers shaped like crabs. The irony. Over the course of hours, relatives sit down to experience the ritual of eating crab. From a distance, it may appear as if a Pinewood Derby car is being constructed as the wooden mallets crash to the table, and the pounding and hammering is deafening. The conversation is light and convivial. It's like a co-ed knitting circle, except people are eating bug meat. I don't participate. Being the father of five young children, my time is normally spent stopping any given number of my basketball team from drowning in the nearby pool. Well, that's my excuse. Even if I were kid-free, I wouldn't partake in this barbaric bug-smashing ritual. Is any meal worth that much work? Are we really supposed to be eating these things? Isn't it a red flag that you need a hammer to eat a crab? Waitress, oh, you're having the crab? Let me get you some tools so you can crack open that bug shell and get that half a bite of bug meat. Crab is like the pistachio of shellfish. In my estimation, there's too much effort for too little reward. An experienced crab eater can find plenty of meat in other parts of the crab during the culinary autopsy. The most crab meat is found in the claw or the pincer of the crab. Pincer. That doesn't sound very appetizing. Let's go with claw. Who wouldn't want to eat a claw? It seems to me that the term claw should actually discourage people from eating crab. The oversized claw is the crab's natural form of defense. Its only weapon against attack. If you picked up a live crab, it will, with great confidence, try to snip off your finger. Snip, snip. The crab must think, nobody's going to get to me because I have these claws. More irony. It's like carrying around a gun and thinking, nobody's going to mess with me while I have this. Why is someone eating my gun? There is also that nasty part of the crab that you are not supposed to eat. I think it's called all of it. Because they are crabs, as in the sexually transmitted disease. That has the same name because it's the exact same thing. I honestly don't know how people even order crabs with a straight face. I imagine a couple on a romantic date with a man trying to impress his lady by ordering for her. Yes, my wife and I will have the crabs. No, actually, I'll get crabs and give her some. Whispering to the waiter, don't tell her, I want it to be a surprise. Apart from its ill-fated name and frightening body, everything about the crab as a creature is creepy. It only moves sideways, to the right, and then jerking to the left. It always looks like it's trying to avoid an awkward situation. Uh-oh, I owe that guy money, as he sidesteps away. I'm sure God is up in heaven looking down completely bewildered. What do I have to do to stop these humans from eating the crabs? I give it a rock-hard shell. I put it on the bottom of the ocean. I named a disease after it. I knew I should have covered it in needles. Over shoulder. Jesus, you're going to have to go back down there. Lobsters, oysters, and crabs. Oh, my. I'm not just freaked out by shellfish. Seafood in general gives me the willies. With most seafood, I don't understand the appeal. Like anchovies? What exactly is the difference between an anchovy and a sweaty eyebrow? Whenever I see an anchovy, I think, someone has attacked Tom Selleck. Why would you want to put that on a pizza? Octopus? Really? Octo meaning eight, puss meaning really?
Yes, the puss part's my favorite.
Damn suction cuts, man, we need a new bathtub, man.
The octopus is really the epitome of the sea monster, initially delighting people as the frightening subject of seafarers' folklore. Now the octopus delights people as high-end cuisine, eaten, of course, after carefully boiling the octopus properly to rid it of its slime, smell, and residual ink. Yum. Many of these odd and unappealing food items are considered delicacies, which is a food term meaning unjustifiably expensive. I suppose each culture has its own definition of what a delicacy might be. Things that are presently considered a delicacy in Western culture mystify me. I understand how you can rationalize some seafood as delicacies, such as fish eggs that were from their mother's womb untimely ripped. But snails? Snails are a delicacy? Compared to what? Barnacles? Slugs? What would you have to be eating on a regular basis to make snails a delicacy?
I normally just eat mud and worms, so when I get a snail, I'm like, score! Snails are hard to come by.
Really? Give me a shovel in 20 minutes. I think everyone is aware how disgusting snails are, and that's why they are served in a bowl of wine and butter and called escargots, which is a French word loosely translated as denial. Initially, they were probably called snails and served in a bucket of sludge. For some reason, no one ordered them. I think the answer to this perplexing riddle of why we are eating any of these questionable items boils down to a simple fact. Humans will eat anything, given the chance. Certainly, I can relate to this concept to an extent. But with some of these edibles, I think we are taking this whole top of the food chain idea a bit too far. Take the squid. Are we really eating the swimming sea spider? But I like fried calamari. Sure, but you could deep fry a rubber hose and it would taste good.
You know, with a little cocktail sauce.